May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Halpern of Winston & Strawn, and I represent petitioner Anthony Guest in this appeal. Mr. Guest's due process claim that he was railroaded by Judge Pompei arises from court proceedings 23 years ago in the Cook County Courthouse. It was the lethal combination of Judge Pompei's inveterate and pervasive corruption, his real and substantial interest in the outcome of Guest's case, and his actual acts of bias at trial that violated Guest's right to a fair trial, desecrated the judicial process, and warrant reversal here. Pompei's conduct was even more outrageous because he executed his scheme in a death penalty case, in a trial where Pompei was both judge and jury. Pompei's conduct is anathema to our judicial system, and our system should not tolerate such despicable behavior in our judiciary. Now, at the outset, there are at least two issues that are undisputed in this case, one a matter of fact, the other law. First, it is undisputed that Pompei was a corrupt judge. As the district court acknowledged, in its own words, there was considerable amount of distressing evidence, including the testimony of numerous firsthand witnesses, witnesses with firsthand knowledge, that Pompei routinely accepted bribes and fixed cases.
And as you indicate, his conduct was reprehensible and inexcusable and as many adjectives as we can come up with. But the problem I have is, and I think the problem you have, is this Bracey case, because wasn't there much stronger evidence of judicial bias in that case, and the Seventh Circuit didn't grant the petitioner relief there?
Well, Your Honor, I think that was one of the errors that the district court made in using a yardstick, the amount of evidence in the Maloney case, of Judge Maloney's corruption, in assessing it against this case. And I don't believe that is in assessing the evidence of Judge Pompei's corruption. The state has acknowledged there was some. The district court acknowledged that the presumption that judges discharge their duties honestly was overcome. And there was staggering, overwhelming evidence of Judge Pompei's corruption. For example, as Your Honor knows from our briefs, in the trial testimony in Judge Maloney's case, it was Judge Pompei's courtroom deputy who testified that there were hundreds of bribes, cash bribes, that he passed along to Judge Pompei. There was staggering evidence. There was an undercover agent testimony with audio tapes of recordings of conversations during the time that this matter was on Judge Pompei's docket, where there was a payoff of $1,300, $1,000 for the judge, $300 for the bailiff, Lucius Robinson, to dismiss a robbery case. And in fact, it was just months before Anthony Guest's trial in this case. During the very period we're talking about, there's evidence that there were 13 felony class X drug cases, of which none of them, these were in bench trials or a motion before Judge Pompei, none of them ended in a conviction on the most serious charge. Nine were either dismissed or nollied after Judge Pompei suppressed the evidence. And in five of the not guilty cases, they were assigned to or represented by defense lawyer Dean Wolfson, who pled guilty to bribery, including to bribery to Judge Pompei. The corruption was so rampant that it was a joke in the Cook County Courthouse that inexplicably dismissed cases were referred to as Motion Lucius, referring to the bailiff who the undercover agent testified in the Maloney trial was a bad man. The testimony of Robinson was devastating. It was clear, it was specific, it was detailed, and it was overwhelming. I mean, absent a confession from the judge, and this court has acknowledged repeatedly that is virtually impossible, there is exceedingly strong direct evidence and very compelling inferences from the testimony and from the other evidence of the corruption, of the historical corruption, of the corruption at the time of Guest's trial, and of his knowledge that there was an investigation. The judge certainly knew that he himself, of his own corruption, and the judge was aware that he would be prime target number one of such an investigation. So that is one area I think that there is just staggering evidence about. I don't know. And as this court has said, the court, recognizing the difficulty of proving such cases and peering into the minds of jurists, that it will consider extrinsic evidence and circumstantial evidence and inferences from that evidence. And I think under that combination, we've fully met that standard in this case. It was also the other undisputed issue, I think, in this case is the legal one, that harmless error analysis is irrelevant if the court finds judicial bias, whether presumed or actual. Reversal is automatic. It's the end of the inquiry. I think the district court applied the wrong standard in requiring Anthony Guest to prove not only historical corruption, but also other aspects or other cases in which compensatory bias took place. That's not the law. That's not his claim. Whatever standard the district court used in assessing the evidence fell short of the standard that this circuit has addressed. And the third error of the court in considering whether there was a violation of the due process right was that it failed to consider whether the trial judge had an interest in the outcome of the case against Guest. That is, a motivation or temptation so great that it is an actual, substantial incentive to be biased. And under such circumstances, bias can be presumed. And that's the law under Del Vecchio. And this court has recognized the Illinois Supreme Court cases of Hawkins and Tutino that identifies the precise motivation that Judge Pompei had in this case. It was one that was irresistible, and it was one that he acted on.
Well, how does that comply with Bracey, though, where it says the actual bias in petitioner's own case? That's what.
That's the next point, because in this, there was actual bias in this case, but the court need not go that far to find bias. It can presume bias based on the actual substantial incentive, the severe temptation, as this court has used the term, that's so severe, and it need not be yielded to, but in and of itself requires reversal. But in this case, Judge Pompei did act on that irresistible temptation, and he did it several ways, and we've outlined them in the brief. I mean, first, right off the bat, with respect to the waiver of his jury rights, this is a fundamental core right in a death penalty case, and this fell into the lap of Judge Pompei in his time, in a very propitious time, because it gave him a great opportunity to try and get the FBI off its back, to divert its attention from him, where someone could be harsh and overcompensate for a history of corruptly induced leniency. And that's what happened here. So number one, at trial, with the judicial proceedings, right off the bat, it was the court, through Lucius Robinson, the court's bailiff, and another unidentified officer, who intervened and helped persuade Guest to waive his constitutional right to a jury trial. And following that, when there should have been an inquiry as to whether the waiver in such an important matter, in such an important case, was knowing and voluntary and intelligent, Judge Pompei did nothing of the sort, nor could he.
Did Robinson, who seemed to be pretty candid about his involvement in this whole thing, did he ever admit to conspiring with Pompei to induce Guest to waive the jury trial?
No, Your Honor, but I would disagree with Your Honor's assessment that he was candid about this. I mean, after all, his testimony was most reluctant, came after the statute of limitations had already expired, and after he was already convicted for perjury, for lying in the grand jury, that he had not made any payoffs to Judge Pompei, and also a separate conviction for tax evasion. I think he was a most reluctant witness, especially in his deposition that followed more recent, around 1999, that followed his testimony in March 1993. But we're not still relying just on what Pompei said. And in fact, Pompei did say it was routine for him to speak to prisoners about waiving a jury trial. And in fact, that was the very M.O. of Judge Pompei, so that he could be in control of the fix and not relegate a situation where he was accepting thousands of dollars of cash bribe payments to the vagaries of a jury verdict. He was in control here. This was no different. This was so that he could control the fix. There are other aspects that played out during the course of the trial. I see the white light is on. And just briefly, those issues where there was no hearing or inquiry about a missing bullet that could very well have been exculpatory. This was a bullet that there was testimony came from the gun that the defendant shot at the security guard. And the security guard, one of two live witnesses at this bench trial, said, here was the bullet. It was recovered in a hospital room by the physician and by a police officer, never to be seen again, no ballistics. So what is there's no inquiry, no hearing, no continuance, no ballistics test in a death penalty case. That reflects a mindset of the judge who has his mind made up and knows where he wants to go and how to get there. So, two more points briefly. One was the curtailment of the cross-examination of Joanne Bailey, who for the first time on the day said that she had seen the victim moments before she saw the defendant and the security guard in the lunchroom. There was critical cross-examination as to her credibility and perception that was cut off by the judge. And finally, there were serious infirmities with the state's evidence based on identifications. There was no eyewitness to the murder itself. There were problems about who the defendant was, and the judge, far from making any specific findings, made only a general finding, and a month later sentenced the defendant to death. If there are no questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir. We'll hear now from Ms. Sheck.
May it please the court, I represent the respondent, Terrence McCann, warden. This case is not governed. It is governed by Bracey, but it is not at all like Bracey. In Bracey, there was a Judge Thomas Maloney, who had actually been convicted of racketeering and of accepting bribes. He had taken a bribe and returned it in Hawkins. In Tatone, he had accepted a bribe. Suano said that testified in the James Davis case that when he did not pay, he in fact did not win his cases, when before that he'd always won in front of Maloney. Judge Maloney had significantly greater guilt and significantly greater evidence against him than did Judge Pompei. Judge Pompei was never indicted. And I recognize that we have the testimony of Robinson saying that he passed bribes to Pompei on several occasions. The trouble with Robinson's testimony is twofold. First, Robinson, of course, is a liar. In the same deposition that he said he passed bribes, he also said, oh, Judge Pompei was an honest and fair judge who would give anyone an even chance. So Robinson's testimony is unreliable. Secondly, Robinson was never specific about dates, times, locations, parties involved. He simply made a blatant statement on hundreds of occasions. In a court of law, this simply did not amount to evidence, not enough evidence to establish proof. It was evidence. It was not enough evidence to establish proof. So the level of evidence of actual corruption was significantly greater in Bracey than it was in this case. We have Mr. Hake's testimony. However, his testimony about what happened in Branch 66 was remote in time. It was not close to the 1983 trial. His testimony that was close to the 1983 trial in the Torres case said he merely gave a bribe to Robinson, and he did not know that Robinson ever gave the bribe then to Judge Pompei. If they could have tied in Mr. Hake's testimony at that point, I presume there would have been an indictment for Judge Pompei, but there was not. Mr. Tobin, who was a public defender who worked in Judge Pompei's case or courtroom, said that he believed that Judge Pompei gave an honest shake to the public defenders, that he did not try and make up his numbers. The bottom line is there is significant evidence in Bracey of corruption. There is not nearly the same evidence in this case. And Judge Williams, as you pointed out, in Bracey, there was not a finding for the petitioner. Relief was not granted to Bracey. His conviction stood. And that is all we're asking for. The sentence is no longer an issue in this case, just the conviction. As Judge Rovner pointed out in her dissent in Bracey, it's a fairly straightforward determination about guilt. It is not the same as the weighing of factors that go into a sentencing hearing. As far as showing the proper standard of review or the proper law applied by the district court said that evidence of compensatory bias in other cases was a factor. It was not the only factor, but a factor that could be considered in determining whether or not the judge had actual bias, or I'm sorry, had shown prior corruption, prior actual bias. As for bias in the petitioner's own case, there simply is nothing. There's absolutely not one thing that they can point to. And again, comparing this with the Bracey case. In the Bracey case, we have a lawyer who is a mob lawyer appointed by Judge Maloney, who Maloney then later tries to get to file an affidavit saying that he was not, in fact, appointed, but that Bracey had hired him. We've got the mob lawyer. He says he answers ready for a death penalty case with 3 weeks without asking for a continuance. In Guest's case, we have a public defender, Dennis Tobin, who was appointed, whose honesty has never been attacked. In Bracey, we have rulings from Judge Maloney.
He did suggest before, if you accept the testimony of Robinson or anybody else, that Mr. Guest should waive the jury trial?
Yes, Mr. Tobin testified that he and Guest together decided to waive the jury trial. In fact, Mr. Tobin was against waiving it, and Mr. Guest, according to Mr. Tobin's deposition, insisted that he wanted to waive the jury because he'd had a previous bad experience where he took a jury trial. He'd had a murder trial out in California where he'd taken a jury. They deliberated extensively but ultimately came back against him. And so Mr. Guest did not want to go forward with a jury trial. Mr. Tobin...
There was some testimony, was there not, that Robinson had at least talked to the defendant about this issue?
Interestingly enough, Mr. Guest's counsel just now said that Robinson testified that he did talk to, if not Guest, other people. In Robinson's deposition, actually, at page 72, Robinson says that he, in fact, did not talk to defendants about waiving a jury trial. He has no recollection of talking to Guest about waiving a jury trial. So although Robinson said that he would help Mr. Tobin if Mr. Tobin asked him to do something for him, he said that he did not talk to defendants about waiving jury trials.
How about the other two matters that are raised, the matter with respect to the missing bullet and also the cross-examination of Bailey?
As far as the missing bullet is concerned, again, counsel for Mr. Guest makes a misstatement when he says there was no hearing. In fact, there was a hearing. Looking back at the original trial transcript, the issue is first raised when King testifies during his direct testimony, says there was a bullet, it was in my shirt, it went to the hospital, it dropped out. A uniformed police officer picked up the bullet. King testified twice, once on the stand, and then they actually went to the jewel itself, the scene of the crime, where he repeated his same testimony. In fact, gave more detail about the bullet. It was an intact bullet. Immediately after King's testimony at the store, Mr. Tobin moved at that point to dismiss all the murder charges against Mr. Guest, or in the alternative, for a mistrial. But Mr. Tobin asked the judge, specifically said at that point, he said, will you hold this, enter and continue it, and consider this at the end of the case in chief. This is at the transcript at page 124. The judge granted his request to enter and continue the hearing on the bullet until the end of the case in chief. At the end of the state's case, they presented all of their evidence. The state then presented 6 live witnesses and stipulations about 9 other witnesses who all testified that they had seen King that night, either on the scene or at the hospital, but they had not had seen a bullet. Mr. Tobin objected that the testimony from the state's witnesses was not enough, was not complete, because there could have been other witnesses out there that the state simply had not called. Nevertheless, the state called every police officer that they were aware of who had come in contact with King that night who said they had no bullet. At the end of... I'm sorry?
Please.
At the end of the defense case, The judge then said, all right, I've heard the evidence on the motion to dismiss. I'm going to give my ruling on the motion to dismiss and on the motion for mistrial now before lunch. Then after lunch, you're going to argue about the case in chief, and I'm going to give a ruling at that point. So, again, this is at the transcript page 247, and at transcript page 263, Judge Pompei specifically denies the motion to dismiss and the motion for a new trial. So there was a hearing. It wasn't a separate hearing that was not intermingled with the trial, but there was nevertheless a hearing, and the judge's rulings repeatedly indicate that he understands that he is giving a separate ruling on the admissibility of the evidence about the bullet. He's determining whether or not that evidence was admissible, whether there should be a mistrial, whether there should be a motion to dismiss, whether dismissal should be granted, and then whether or not guilt should attach. So there was a hearing. It was intermingled with the trial, but there was a hearing on the bullet. As far as Joanne Bailey is concerned, again, there was no real limitation on the cross. The section that counsel refers to, the defense counsel, Mr. Tobin, is trying to establish how long before the bullets or the shots were fired that Mr. Giever, the victim, had actually been in the cafeteria. What was the time frame? And he was going about it in an awkward way. He actually asked her, well, were you on a lunch break or a shorter break? What did you have for lunch? Did you bring it from home? I mean, he was definitely going afield. Judge Pompei even went so far as to say, you know, Mr. Tobin, you're just cluttering the record. But Mr. Tobin was able to bring this information out at other times. At the transcript, page 169, Tobin was able to bring out that Bailey had been in the cafeteria for 5 minutes before Mr. Giever walked in. Again, at 169, she said Mr. Giever had only been in the cafeteria for about 1 second. At 171, she said that the shots were fired about 1 minute after Mr. Giever left. She was slightly inconsistent at 145, where she said that it had only been seconds, but nevertheless, she agrees both times it was a short time. She says at 154 that King and Mr. Guest were in the cafeteria for about 4 seconds before the shooting began. So the point is, the information that Mr. Tobin was trying to bring out, the impeachment or the information he was trying to bring about how long it had been before Mr. Giever left the cafeteria, was in fact brought out. There is no question that that evidence was before the judge, and the cross-examination was not limited. And again, this goes to, you know, could there have been someone else in the basement with a gun who fired the shot? And again, the state's position has always been that Mr. Guest was down there with a gun. Mr. Guest was shooting. Witnesses saw Mr. Guest run without the gun, run out throughout the store while holding the gun, that Mr. Guest was in fact the shooter. So again, the state's position, the respondent's position, is that this case is simply not nearly as compelling as the Bracey case. This court found in Bracey that the conviction should stand. Again, the sentencing is not an issue here, just the conviction, where there is a convicted judge, absolute proof of his corruption, evidence of some interest during the course of the trial in Bracey, and relief is not granted here, where we have a judge never indicted and absolutely not one shred of evidence of anything amiss at the trial. We ask that this court affirm the finding of the lower court and deny the petition for writ of certiorari.
Thank you, Ms. Jack.
Thank you.
How much time do we have? Sir, you have 3 minutes.
First, I would say that Bracey is informative, but not absolutely controlling in this case. And I think Bracey needs to be read critically among the other cases that deal with judicial bias, including that address the issue of interest in the outcome of a case where there is such a strong temptation, and also actual bias, because interest in the outcome of the case was not raised in Bracey, nor in this case was the claim that there are other cases of compensatory bias. It's this particular case, and it's particularly acute because unlike in Bracey, Judge Pompei was aware that there was an investigation going on. I'd like to refer the court, this part of the sealed record, it's number 152, Exhibit 2, generally at 37 to 42, and also at 79 to 80 about Pompey's specific knowledge of the investigation. So he had an acute interest to act on an irresistible temptation. So read Brady, I would urge the court respectfully, but in the context of the rest of the Supreme Court's law and this and the law of this court. In terms of the specifics of the evidence, there was very specific evidence by Robinson, including his dealings with another judge, Judge Olson, who was referring matters, cases, to Judge Pompey and arranging for bribes to be passed. The fact that in the Torres case, they didn't know whether the bribe was actually paid to the judge. Well, we know it was. The case was dismissed by Judge Pompey just months before before the Guest case. In terms of the Tobin waiver of the jury, he testified that, yeah, ultimately it was the client's decision to make that. But his analysis and advice was based on an understanding that Judge Pompey came by his judicial philosophy of leniency and not having sentenced anyone to death, that he came by that legitimately. That was not the case. This hearing, by the way, in terms of the missing bullet, well, that wasn't really much of a substantive hearing to call every police officer, but they didn't call the police officer. At least the police officer wasn't identified who was in the hospital room with Guest, nor was the treating physician. Where was a hearing that that allowed that to address the issue of a chain of custody? It's not. It's very difficult to address something where you just say, here's every police officer and we don't know anything about it. That's not a, a substantive hearing, whether there were six or there were nine witnesses. With respect to Bailey, it's very important. She was one of only two live witnesses. She said for the first time 2 years after she was after the murder and after she was interviewed that she saw the victim in the room. So the issue of the timing, and she changed her testimony about various aspects. Read it, it's in the trial transcript, but it was very important. If I just may finish, Your Honors. Judge Pompey's toxic formula of corruption and bias worked a judicial abomination in this case that had dire and real consequences for Anthony Guest. Even from this cold record of 23 years ago, it's clear there was a violation of his due process rights to a fair trial before an impartial tribunal. He was deprived of that fundamental right through the judicial bias of Judge Pompey in two ways, through his interest in the outcome and actual bias. And we'd ask that the court respectfully reverse the conviction in this case, or alternatively, the case be remanded with instructions on any issues of fact. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Halpern. Mr. Halpern, you served by appointment of the court, and you have the deep thanks of the court for having taken that appointment. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.